Did you get groceries this weekend? Because if you did, you probably were somewhat acutely aware of some of the things that we know grocery stores do, right? We know for a fact that groceries put the eggs and the butter and some of the other more essential stuff that people always want towards the back of the store, so you have to run past everything else in between in hopes that you'll end up buying something else along the way. This weekend, I read The Secret Life of Groceries by Benjamin Lohr, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. And this book is, I think, very well researched. I think it's also incredibly well written. It takes a very relatively boring topic of groceries and makes it into a very informative, challenging, reflective experience. It's a little bit dark and a little bit sad at spots. I thought going into it that it would be largely about things like animal rights abuses, and it turned out to be so much more than that. But before we begin, there is something about grocery stores worth knowing. And he talks about this a little bit, bits and pieces in the book, but in no one particular section. Grocery stores, particularly supermarkets, are the best that everything capitalism has to offer, right? They have capitalism provides supermarkets with all of the resources that they need. They are the embodiment, I think, of capitalism to the extreme and all of the good things that come from that. However, they also come with a lot of the bad things that are indicative of capitalism and sort of the pursuit of a lot of lower prices. Consider for a moment that in the 1900s rather, the average American spent about 40% of their income on food. Today, we spend about 30 or 40% of our incomes, roughly on average annually, on things like housing. Transportation costs are usually about a third of people's incomes in most places without robust mass transit systems. And we've largely shrunk our food budgets to about anywhere between 7 and 15% of our incomes, depending on sort of who you are and what your diet consists of. Obviously, a family of four is going to have a much higher food budget than, say, a solo person who eats frozen pizzas and TV dinners. But by and large, we have pretty affordable food prices. Now, that comes with a host of reasons for how that came to be. And this book is sort of an investigation into those practices and about how even high-end grocery stores have made us into a society where we have all of this excess, all of this want, anything that you want, all these commodities almost on demand at all the time. There's almost, with the exception of some seasonal things like Halloween candy, almost nothing comes and goes from the shelves based off of any sort of seasonality to it. There's a line in here that I want to read because I have multiple notes about things that I think is incredibly indicative of sort of the level of research that the author went to and the kind of people that he spoke to. And it sort of set a tone for the rest of the book. And he says, when you expand to the scale of even a small grocery change, the economic factors can't help but envelop everything else. Qualities like ethics and aesthetics get swallowed by the market and reduced to price. The average store has 32,000 individual products known as shopkeeping units or SKUs. The biggest have more than 120,000 SKUs. Accordingly, the men and women who sell our food, who work amidst this volume, see our food differently than you or I. In particular, they see it as a line on a spreadsheet with reams of qualities arranged in columns, all weighed by various coefficients according to their particular proprietary model that culminates in one or two numbers used to determine its value. That same item they might have eaten for breakfast transubstantiates into something entirely non-ecological when they head to work, not really that different from thumbtacks or paper towels, though perhaps with slightly more fragile handling conditions. He goes on to say, this is something those on the inside are acutely aware of. Once talking to a slaughter plant supervisor, a man who proudly declared he'd been present for the execution of 800 million chickens, I listened as he practically broke down describing the moments just after a chicken's death. The man was detailing the procession of events that leads to slaughter. After the catchers come through in their overalls, grabbing up the birds by hand, after they stuff the birds into the horizontal cages by transport, money cotton balls jammed against the steel, and after the cages are driven miles and miles to the plant, then removed by forklift, and the birds are yanked out, again by hand, and hung upside down on the line by their yellow scaly feet, they head towards a machine that will slice their carotid artery, 140 birds a minute, while a man in a bloodstained smock looks on with raised knife, ready in case the machine misses, and he has to step forward to finish the job. After the man in the neck slicing, the birds, still twitching, still warm, draining out, and in short, still very much animals, though dying ones, are whisked into a dark metallic tunnel. This is the place where the slaughter plant supervisor's voice wells up during his description. The tunnel continues through to a new room, but inside, encased in industry, invisible except on blueprints and design plans, something happens. The bird is blasted with hot steaming water, beaten by rubber flanges so its feathers fall off in ragged clumps. It is cleansed at an existential level until on the other side of this tunnel, the chicken emerges into a new room, now a decapitated, drained thing, all white-pocked skin, a whizzling, gleaming globe of meat racing forward on the line. There is a phase shift. The floors are now bloodless. Men and women in white smocks stand at green plastic counters, and the whole area radiates with the high, reassuring notes of chlorine. Quote, this is the place, this is the precise point. They go from living thing to food. You watch it happen, he says, his voice breaking as he breaks into tears, but not in the remorseful or guilt-ridden sense, in the I am blessed and witness to the miraculous sense. Quote, they come out and they are no longer an animal. They are food now. It is a fundamental rite of civilization, a moment where industry mimics the god, but rather than breathing new life into dust, a different consecration occurs, of sucking life out, an act of not just absolving murder, but erasing the possibility. That might be a little overwritten in some context to describe basically how a chicken slaughterhouse works, but he goes on to talk in the book about how he worked with a nonprofit group to sort of sneak in at one point to look at a pig farm, an industrial pig operation, where he goes in and he talks about how in a room full of about 100 or 150,000 pigs, some number of them have tumors and rashes and other ailments or limps and things. But he rightly questions, if you had a room full of 150,000 human beings, how many of them would be pocked with tumors and rashes and bruises and other sorts of ailments? It doesn't have to say that all industrial farm operations are fine and hunky-dory. I think we all know that they are absolutely not. I thought this book would be much more about the meat processing side of things, and it's not. This is kind of the extent of it. There's actually a section in the back about aquaculture that we'll get to in a bit. And that is, I think, far more sad, depressing, illustrative of kind of the market that we see ourselves in on a lot of these things. But he has done the work to get himself as close to or inside the various bits of machinery that make up this market as possible. One of the places that he gets close to is with Joe Colomb, who is the Joe of Trader Joe's. And he talks a little bit about how sort of groceries came to be, right? And he talks a little bit about how grocery stores grew. He writes at a point here early on about the history of Piggly Wiggly. He says, at the time, this being in the 1950s or so, loss from theft was almost 6%. So unlike conventional markets of the era, George Saunders decides to separate the entry and exit points of the store. Pictures of the first Piggly Wiggly are filled with obtrusive steel fencing surrounding the turnstiles, evoking a prison yard rather than food mart, preventing shoppers from nabbing an item and running. The entire effect creates the modern retail dynamic. Passing through the turnstile, the customer enters an unconscious bargain. You are invited in to frolic among the abundance, but expected to pay in the end. And this is what he says goes on to describe grocery shopping and just retail in general as a far more personal act. And he shares all sorts of wonderful bits of history about how everything from sales and pricing and store layout consumer psychology really come into their own in this period, kind of starting around World War II, but immediately after, where there's so much abundance and so much pressure and focus on pursuing the lowest price. This, however, is where we differ a little bit with the Joe of Trader Joe's. And he talks about in a sort of a one-on-one interview with Joe about the early days of Trader Joe's and sort of what his ethos was about that. He says, if you've been inside one, you know the store Joe would go on to create is not the largest nor the cheapest. It was not the first at anything in particular, nor did it punctuate the equilibrium of the grocery world like Cullen's bomb. It did not pioneer a new technology or revolutionize the buying experience in any tangible way as Clarence Saunders did. It does not have the most luxurious, sustainable, ethical, or health-conscious food out there, and in all those attributes, it is strictly unremarkable. Instead, it did something both more mystical and impressive. In an industry with innovations that all look and feel banal because they tinker with superficials, Joe advanced by looking deeper. In the process, he changed the fundamentals of the game. Joe interrogated the retailer-shopper relationship. He rethought what it meant to sell food, the core responsibilities of retailer, the latent desires of the customer, peeling back the surface of the buying experience like it was a scalp to reveal the substrate below. As many have remarked, he created a cult. But it is a cult that would go on to take over the mainstream. Like it or not, shop there or not, you as an American in 2020 are probably a member of that cult, either in the specific sense that you are the precise demographic Joe targeted way back then, the overeducated, underpaid, and inquisitive, the customer who understands and cares for the world foremost by understanding and caring for themselves, or in the general sense, you are a consumer who flourishes from demographic targeting, expressing yourself through your purchases, loyalties, and decisions. What Joe did was, and was one of the first to do, if not the first, was to create a store that provides products that reflect an identity that exists in opposition to some generally homogenized mainstream. In the process, by necessity, he commodified individuality itself. He learned to sell you, you, if you were the precise you he was after. That can be a little hard to appreciate. It can be a little hard to sort of say, oh yeah, you really got me there. I read that and I was like, yeah, that definitely sort of fits the bill for a lot of people who I think shop at Trader Joe's and do so not because they value getting, you know, their milk from Trader Joe's. They can get milk from any place. It's not that much different than a lot of other milk. But he goes on to talk about how Trader Joe's has developed as a retail operation and how it puts it on success as the single highest sales per square foot of any retail grocery chain, basically doubling its nearest competitor of Whole Foods. And then he goes on into a discussion about Aldi and the Aldi brothers, who now currently own Trader Joe's. Joe sold his stake in the company and left at some point, I think in the early 2000s. Particularly as the Aldi brothers were interested in expanding out of Europe and into the United States. He goes on to say, in this way, Joe made me believe in the idea of business, or rather he made me see what business could be. Our society is awash with founders all listening to the same leadership podcasts, doing the same kettlebell lunges to improve grip and leg strength at the same time, then dissolving identical Tim Ferriss-approved muscle-building complexes into their post-workout shakes to transform their previously similar mesomorph bodies into something even more metabolically equivalent, all while making parallel grandiose-style projections about their own app, disruption, or innovation, whereby their personal self-interest miraculously aligns with the interest of society writ large and places them as CEO, founder, servant leader on the very prow of the vessel of civilization. It is lunacy, but somehow it is our lunacy, the ascendant lunacy of my generation, which has put IPO-chasing founders in the same category we once reserved for poets, statesmen, and philosophers. And so it is with the wariness that I bring up the cliche about business being a creative act. But hey, that's what Joe made me see. He has the empath's ability to toggle back and forth between different perspectives, to be able to obsess over detail and zoom out to the bigger picture, as well as a world-class comfort with intuition and nonlinear process. Quote, "The most important thing to know about a man is whether he is right or left-handed," he tells me. "Dyslexia lurks in the brain of every left-hander, which means we see the world differently, sometimes profitably. He shunned the limelight and never strove for fame, not personally nor for his brand. Joe was a student, and understanding his career in grocery is a humanism, a man trying to learn as much as he can about people, life, and cultural shifts. It is one of the more helpful ways to think about the reason for his success and what grocery has to offer." I found the story. I always find the stories and histories of founders and people who create great success in their lives and the lives of others to be fascinating. And this particular sort of fit the bill for that. It, you know, he describes Joe as somebody who is probably a polymath to some extent, or at the very least, probably a genius level. That's me talking, not him, because he describes him as somebody who can remember all sorts of dates and details. He knows every, you know, every employee by name, knows their spouse's names, knows their birthdays, knows when they were hired, was also somebody who was keen to learn every part of the job. Everything from marketing to sort of discovering what wines work best. And he also is an astute businessman to be able to navigate lots of the laws, particularly in California where they started, surrounding liquor. And that, you know, is sort of how Trader Joe's rose to fame, was by being incredibly passionate about his work. And I don't like that word passion so much. I think that most people's passions are not great lines of work by and large. And to create a grocery store today is not the same way or the same kind of grocery store that Joe had the opportunity to back in the 60s and 70s. That era has changed. And the book goes into detail about how and why that is as you read through it. And the whole thing is an incredibly detailed, intimate account of his experience running a grocery store, what it meant to him. And you sort of feel the emotion of that as he writes about what he's asking him and what he's saying in response. And you also get a deep appreciation for a person who built something who also cared very deeply about what it was that he was doing. Also in this book, he goes on to move from the grocery store and back up a little bit into the distribution lines of things. And he follows a truck driver, actually gets with a female truck driver who agrees to let him ride along from an Aldi distribution center in Wisconsin. And they go around far and wide as North Carolina, and I think even points south. And he goes on to say and to write about Lynn Riles, who is the trucker that he's with. He describes her as this coughing, sputtering, stumbling trucker, clicks leashes on her two beagles and clambers down the 5-foot drop from the driver's side door to walk them in the parking lot below. 14 minutes later, twin coffees steaming in the front seat, we're rolling out to an Aldi distribution center on a mission to deliver a load of groceries. They don't actually know what they're delivering. They don't find out until they deliver it that it's, I think, whipped cream or some sort of like Cool Whip style product. He says, "I didn't seek out this most elemental point in distribution so much as sink into it. Repertorially gravitating toward Lynn Riles, no different from water when it settles to the lowest point after all other outlets are sealed. And make no mistake, all other outlets were sealed. In general, has been well reported by others, industrial food is a paranoid business. Big, fat, pushy corporations all clinging to their tiny edge, well burned by bad press, convinced that their customers are skittish and insane, best treated like children, to be protected for their own good from information that they can neither assess nor understand. It's a self-serving parochialism, but not completely unfounded. People are skittish and insane when it comes to their food. They not only want, they demand, through buying power, completely impossible, unsustainable opposites, low price and high quality, immediate availability and customized differentiation, and then react apoplectically to the often ingenious, if Frankensteinian, solutions industrial food creates to bridge the gap." that is this book in a nutshell. It is describing, particularly in America, but in the West, and I think increasingly globally, people's desire for cheap and excellent. And that is capitalism 101 right there, delivering a ever better product at better quality for a better price. You can disagree with parts of capitalism, and there's plenty to disagree with. That is one good thing of it. Again, we don't spend as much money on our food today as we used to, but those costs get externalized into other places. And this is me talking and not the author, but those costs probably should get accounted for a lot more often than they do. And this book does an excellent job of walking you through this beyond just what we know in terms of industrial farm operations, for example, but the reality of costs that people by and large seem totally fine with, even when they do understand those costs. To talk again a little bit about Lynn Reed, he writes, from there, reality continues to intercede. The fuel surcharge almost never covers her actual expense. The truck is supposed to be able to make 6 miles per gallon when fully loaded, but we never break 4.5 miles per gallon the entire time I'm riding with her. This 4.5 mile per gallon is also exclusively driving time. It doesn't count the quarter tank Lynn estimates she loses when we idle overnight. And this is me talking here. They idle overnight in truck stops. So because they obviously need to sleep, but also because, and depending on the weather, they may need to either keep the material that they're hauling cold, which in this case they do, or they need to keep themselves heated or cool, depending on the temperature outside. He continues on, that quarter tank, by the way, is not the quarter tank of your Honda sedan. Lynn's Peterbilt has two tanks on each side, both massive, 120 gallons on the driver's side, 150 on the passenger side, not to mention a 50-gallon refrigerator tank that keeps our veggies crisp and that lasts only 24 hours when Lynn is hauling a load. And he writes in a footnote, and the footnotes in this book are excellent, by the way. This is where you can do some greenhouse gas calculations in your head and realize that even if you are driving the most virtuous Prius, Tesla, Volt in the world, your lifestyle is still burning through hydrocarbons like the Dickens. Our trucking fleet consumes gasoline in an unimaginable manner. Rivers burned every night across America. He goes back to talk a little bit more about his experience with the cost of our trucking industry. Then there are the fixed costs that aren't taken out of this particular load, but need to be accounted for somehow. Lynn pays taxes per mile, per state, and that needs an accountant to handle the complexity of that, or at least the trucking company who issues her check demands that she use one. They also demand that she retain their lawyers to handle billing disputes. Then there is insurance, also demanded by their carrier without the opportunity to shop around. Then maintenance on her truck, which when you drive 12,000 miles a month is a whole different ball of wax than regular car maintenance. Then an escrow account called her security, to which, again, she is contractually obligated to contribute, which is maintained by the trucking company, held entirely at their discretion, and that serves as a backstop should she ever throw up her arms and decide she wants to walk away from her lease-to-own agreement. Finally, there are a host of tiny fees for administrative work, for mapping devices, mobile communication terminals, some of which she can't completely explain even as they bleed her paycheck. And finally, there are the inherent risks, which, as an owner-operator, Lynn has assumed entirely on behalf of her trucking company. The week before I joined her, while she dozed at a truck stop, the driver next to her crunched into her. Lynn awoke to the jolt and scrambled out of her bunk, only to watch as the driver fled the lot. She guesses he was a rookie and his whole career was on the line. One early crash and you're out. But regardless of his identity, she was stuck with an insurance claim. I bring this up because that ever-diminishing sum we calculated Lynn would make for the load, which, this is me talking, historically, in the context of this chapter, the advertising that you see from trucking companies is kind of what, and the promises that they make includes things in this circumstance up to about $1,200 from, I think it was from Wisconsin to the distribution center from, you know, someplace within a couple hundred miles of there. Those mileage estimates are, well, they're definitely estimates, but they don't include a lot of the taxes and fees and other diminishing sums that he's talking about here. So he goes on to say, I bring this up because the ever-diminishing sum we calculated Lynn would make for the load consisted of her earnings before beginning the trip. The open road is unpredictable in almost every way except one. The longer you are on it, the more certain something costly will happen. It takes a shift in mindset, one the rookie driver almost never makes. But this is not about bad luck. A hit and run might be rare, but it is just one risk among thousands. Trailer brakes failing, tires blowing, reefer line freezing that collectively become inevitable. In this case, the damage was exclusively to her fairing. The plastic paneling around the undercarriage is the best possible outcome. She goes on to talk about sort of other fees and other situations that she in, but in the whole estimate that they had, including the other fees that she had to consume, she got maybe $100. Think about that. He goes on to write that she works more than 70 hours the week I am with her, much of it spent in a state of constant vigilance, where she sleeps in 4 to 5 hour bursts and wakes up for 3:30 a.m. and appointments that are make or break for her career, but ignored by the distribution center on the other side. That in context is when she gets paid to drive from someplace from point A to point B, when she arrives at one of those points, either at the beginning or the end, and they have to wait for a distribution center to either open a dock and load or unload her truck, that is time that's unpaid. But she also is liable for her truck in those circumstances. And so she ends up spending a lot of time, she says, playing Farmville. He goes on to say, who didn't see her mother for 2 years because she didn't have the time off and couldn't get loads that lined up with her mother's location. The $17,000, also based on my experience with her, is a number likely inflated by pride. That $17,000 was her estimate for her annual income. That's what her take home was. When he asked her what she made last year after all of the fees, all of the fuel costs, all of the legal issues and the insurance issues and all the other stuff that comes out of her paycheck, she estimates that she made $17,000. And he writes, that's a number likely inflated by pride. The week that I'm with her, Lynn receives a weekly paycheck for just $100, which is what she received the week before and the week before that. She says in this book that it's in her contract that no matter how many expenses that she has, she always gets a check for $100. And he goes on to explain too a lot of the economics behind this and where they're sourcing drivers from. Lynn is an unusual character because A, she's a woman in an industry that's maybe only 4 or 5% women, but also because trucking tries to get people to be owner operators. It's better for the trucking companies in those circumstances. And you can imagine for all the reasons why that is. And a lot of people seem to get tricked into doing that. Other reasons is that they think they actually can make a go of it. Lynn was one of those people, and I don't get the impression, I don't think he does either, from this book or from her experience with her, that she was somehow bamboozled into buying this truck. But a lot of people do. And if you don't do it, if you don't become an owner operator, and you just decide, hey, I just want to work and I just want to drive the truck and you'll give me the truck and you'll pay me and that's just going to be the end of it. You don't get any miles. The trucking companies are very good, evidently, at getting people to understand, no, you don't play ball that way. The way we'd like you to play ball is by becoming an owner operator and you buy this truck off of us. And when you get it paid off, good for you. Of course, like any other vehicle, it's probably useless at that point. But it's a fascinating and eye-opening account of life on the road. And because it's, I think, important to understand this even further, he writes about a situation with another young woman truck driver who trained with Lynn. And he says, quote, one night, about 9 months after their training, Lynn got a phone call from a number she didn't recognize. Lynn answered, and it was Amy, the person she was training or had been in training with, I should say. And she was crying. They raped her underneath the trailer, Lynn tells me, staring straight ahead at the road. There is 4 feet of clearance there. Nobody heard her scream. She crawled back to her truck and I was the first person she called. I was 200 miles away. We talked all night long. Then Lynn explained to her dispatcher that she had an emergency to attend, did not wait for his response, unhitched her trailer and drove to Amy. I took her to the hospital. While they did the rape kit, she kept telling me she was screaming at the top of her lungs and nobody came to help her. I didn't know what to say. I just cried with her. She didn't have anyone else. I only knew her from her training, but I didn't really know her at all. Then, oh damn, and for the first time in 1,000 miles, Lynn goes completely silent and we continue driving through the West Virginia Valley. The story behind this has some other additional context about her fear, the fear of other women who are in the trucking industry, how those fears are never really followed up upon, that it is all the worst things that you imagine an industry of like trucking would be. And we apparently seem relatively powerless to do anything about it. And as truckers like to say, absolutely everything that we have in this world comes to us on a truck. Almost nothing, even things that come by boat and then by train, make their final destination in almost every circumstance by a truck. And it's sad and it's tragic. It's particularly sad and tragic when you consider sort of the economic factors that drive a lot of people to become truck drivers. There's also the economic realities of being a truck driver. And he goes on to explain how most of them are almost always homeless insofar as they don't have an address. They can't, you know, why would they spend money on an apartment or a house that they're almost never going to be in? Or if they aren't married, would sit empty most of the time. It talks a lot about sort of the emotion that comes out of a lot of these things. And it is eye-opening. And this book does an excellent job of explaining some of this stuff. Continuing on in the same chapter about Lynn, he writes, "The longer I spend with Lynn, the more context she provides on her life and decisions, the more important meaning becomes here too. I come to see her as dedicated to a dream. Lynn is vigilant on the road, her attention thousand-eyed and all-seeing behind the wheel. I see her save lives when totally unaware sedans try to beat her to a merge lane. Off the road, I see a remarkable persistence, what she calls her ability to take it, do her duty and withstand, a sense of obligation that also rhymes with an ability to shut down, swallow pride, and self-contain. In our time together, I watch as she gets pelted with petty aggravations, canceled loads, endless hours of unpaid labor, impossible deadlines, outright lies, and none of that, from the most unfair to the most aggravating, is greeted with anything more than a chin-tucked, head-down, plow-forth attitude." And he goes on to talk about other truck drivers that he met with that are, you know, fit some of the more stereotypes, but are also undeniably sharp and often wise in their own ways. It's a fascinating read, and I highly recommend the book just for this particular point. After the trucking and distribution components of this, he goes on to talk about the fancy food show. And here we come in a chapter called Self-Realization Through Snack. and the fancy food show is kind of what you think it is. It's a big convention with people hawking all sorts of things that they hope will be the next breakthrough product that Walmart's going to pick up and purchase, or that Kroger's going to pick up and purchase, and it's just going to take the world by storm. And he goes into this fancy food show and talks about how kind of Americana and fun that it is. He says, "In many ways, we are living in the age of specialty," because this event focuses on specialty foods. "The entire category gesturing towards an authenticity the rest of the food system left behind. The fact that the authenticity itself is so splintered, contradictory, and chaotic is almost identical to our craving for it. It is personal. One man's specialty is another man's scorn. But like many things personal, the effect of seeing it all smashed side by side in a convention center is vaguely debasing. There are vomitous streams of comfort and nostalgia, every trope of Americana, mason jars and aprons, bonnets and barns, colliding with equally vomitous visions of the techno-future, a sphere of gelato pulled by tongs from a cauldron of liquid nitrogen, marshmallows cut so aggressively square as if by laser, their form is basically a middle finger to the whole concept of the s'more. And then there are hot sauces, 10,000 little bottles at 10,000 little booths, each with a howling mouth stretched open on the label. Browsing them, sampling in little dots of red and brown, I start to see all the sauces as a stand-in for the whole show. We aren't at a food conference. This is the hive mind of my confidence, or my comp, excuse me. This is the hive mind of my condiment drawer, a gibbering id of anxiety and acquisition responsible for all those decaying bottles in my fridge." This was, I highlighted that only because I thought the writing was very good at describing something as so mundane and ordinary as a food show. The hot sauce and convention model reminded me of one of my first college classes when I was at IU. when I was studying some graphic design work there, we had a professor who assigned us the process of analyzing labels on hot sauce. And he brought in a bunch of them from the grocery store, and he looked at the labels, and we sort of discussed what each one of them felt like, right? Like, this one must be like super, super hot, and this one over here must be a little milder, and this one kind of gives you a little more authentic flair because it has the picture of a Mexican woman on it, for example. And in reality, when you look at the ingredient label, you realize they are all almost identical. There is no difference between their spiciness or their level of heat. They are almost identical with the exception of labeling. And the book does a good job of talking about labeling in relation to a thing called slossa. He meets this lady at the fancy food show called Julie. And she is on a mission to sort of bring slossa, S-L-A-W-S-A, a mix of slaw and salsa, that's sort of a cabbage condiment mix, to the American public. And he follows her throughout the book, and I won't spoil it, but there's a very fascinating backstory there. It's all very human. It's also very, it's very 21st century model of things, where he follows her on a mission, working ridiculous hours, going to extreme lengths. And really, the takeaway that I had from it was that despite all of her effort and all of her best efforts and best thought about what to do in terms of marketing and outreach and how to grow this slossa brand, it almost entirely came down to blind luck. And I think that there's something worth remembering about that. He also talks about how the process of creating something like slossa on a sort of a small scale works. And he talks about Golding Farms, and this is an industrial space, I think in North Carolina, maybe it was in West Virginia, where a lot of this stuff happens. And so he writes, "Unlike so many other industrial spaces I visited while researching this book, it smells like food. The line is impeccably clean, polished cement and shined up stainless steel, not so much as a stray drop from the thrashing machines just inches away. Instead of smelling like machinery, the space is sweet and heavy and makes me oddly hungry. The muckraker in me wishes I could write about dirty conditions or workers throwing themselves from the scaffolding into bubbling vats to escape their drudgery, but alas, this was simply not the case. Instead, my overriding memory of Golding Farms is of order and precision and of almost perfect cleanliness. A cleanliness that really did hearken to godliness, if only in its approach to an absolute state of being." And I appreciated this little bit about it because it struck me as very honest, and it sort of revealed a truth about the food industry, and that there are certainly abuses in a lot of these things, but that a lot of it is good, that a lot of it is doing well. And he goes on to talk about other abuses and other parts of the distribution and food process, or the food making process, I should say. He mentioned this also frequently in the book, talks about how other people refer to food as product. I can't bring myself to refer to food as product. I think it's too disjointed. There's something about that I just don't like. I don't like the idea of describing things as like premium product. The only thing that I think that should be described as premium should be gasoline, and something about it just seems so disjointed. I have the same reaction sometimes when insurance agents talk about their insurance products, like, "Oh, well, we introduced this new product on the market." And it's like, it's an insurance plan. It's hard to think about it as a product, but these folks certainly do. And part of me wonders if that isn't unhealthy for our food network or in our national id as to how we think about certain things, and that we seem to disrupt it from the notion of being food and treating it more like product. Anyway, he writes in a book back about the retail experience. Here he is working at a Whole Foods. He actually got himself a job working at the seafood counter at a Whole Foods in Brooklyn. And during his training, he talks about what they go through, and he says, Quote, at some point, we turn our attention to customer service. We learn about the 7 different types of difficult customers, a sort of late capitalist version of Snow White and her dwarfs, featuring angry, whiny, hysterical, very important, the chatterbox, the know-it-all, and Mr. Multitasker. I think we all know some of those people, don't we? We learn that we must treat these challenging guests with respect because it costs 6 times more money to attract a new customer than it does to keep an old one, and because, above all, Whole Foods is in the business of saving money, phrased here as efficiency, and linked heavily with the mission of being green. From there, we learn that Mr. Green is the Orwellian name for the Whole Foods internal security team, and that if we see something shady, we should head directly to the loudspeaker and page him, where an undercover security detail will swoop on the scene and pounce on the troublemakers. This is followed by a crash course in the modern organic movement, which is shockingly, even movingly for a cynic like me, nuanced, calling out the idea that organic does not mean healthier, but rather is an option to pay extra to limit the externalities of production, and which focuses on unsexy aspects of organic, like soil conservation and groundwater runoff, rather than borderline falsehoods like nutrient density and/or the overblown pesticide claims that we could use to upsell customers. He goes on to say that in his training, the manager who's leading the training puts up the ingredients list for a non-organic, probably GMO box of cookies and says, quote, your body is going to have to work a lot harder to break down all those ingredients with long names, end quote, as if there were a relationship between linguistic and gastric digestion. Everyone, including jury, nods along in appreciation of this information. There's a footnote, though, during this section about mission of being green. He says the conjoining of efficiency and green becomes a leitmotif throughout these sessions and serves as proxy for both the central tenet of Whole Foods, the organization writ large, and the subliminal message being whispered to each Whole Foods customer writ small. Namely, that by serving yourself, you are also serving humanity. And that is not only a lack of ingenuity and concern that prevents us as a species from having it all. All meaning Mother Earth, honoring Mother Earth while eating really high quality squash in the specific sense, but which in the general sense is more about the life we deserve as intelligent, well-intentioned Americans living in 2020, where gratitude and giving back are two of the many things included in the concept of abundance that we have become to demand from our lifestyle and our grocery store. He also goes on to say that all the recycling bins are completely and utterly bogus at Whole Foods. I think this is common in almost every city and almost every place. I originally thought that maybe this was something that was only common in places like here in Indianapolis, where our recycling programs are basically non-existent. But he goes on to say that sadly, but totally predictable note that you already know in your heart, recycling in practice at Whole Foods and every other grocery store I worked at for this book was entirely and hopelessly screwed. He does not use the word screwed there. I don't care what corporate claims or the rhetoric in the training trash at the fish counter got placed liberally in every bin, less the result of apathy, more from the blitz of the job in the day. This was true of employees and customers alike, and inevitably, each night, most of the bags from the blue recycling bins would be taken in place in exactly the same landfill dumpster as the bags from the gray non-recycling bins. I think that that's probably a scenario that if it's happening in Brooklyn, it's probably happening at every place. Particularly if it's happening at a Whole Foods in Brooklyn, someplace that you would think would be very concerned with their brand, that I think we're all just hopelessly screwed there. Also, as part of the retail experience, he has a moment to talk about sort of his experience with the customers. And he says, one of the first things you realize working grocery is that people in general are hideous and insane, but their depravity almost miraculously bounces out in the ledger of the day. So that aside from bruised feelings and egos, which never really balance, the store itself makes out just fine. You'll have a tiny little man who can barely see above the counter berating you to cut a slab of the $32.99 per pound king salmon into progressively smaller and smaller pieces as if to prove some volumetric version of Archimedes' paradox until you are left with reams of unsalable king salmon that he promptly walks away from because you screwed it all up and that it isn't what he asked for at all. And then minutes later, an old woman with a blue beret and a lakeshore lockjaw accent will walk through the very mincemeat that you just cut and declare that she'll take it. When you double check to make sure she realizes she's about to buy a pound of Wild King salmon ribbons at $32.99, she'll note curtly that while she does have children, there is nothing she adores more than her pet turtles, and no food is too dear for them. again, I mentioned this because it stands as sort of a sense of honesty. I think that he must have kept impeccable notes throughout his whole process. If he researched this over 5 years, and I would believe that it took him every bit of that, then he definitely did an excellent job of either writing down what he saw at the time that he saw it, or updating his notes at the end of every single day. He did a marvelous job at that. And so I applaud the author for his attention to detail on these things. He goes on to talk about sort of the grind of working in retail and how just in time scheduling has sort of become a scourge on retail. And I think probably this is one of those things that we're going to need to have some sort of, at some point, some legal mechanism to deal with. He writes, human capital management, quote, just-in-time scheduling and lean supply chains all have their roots in 1950s Japanese automobile manufacturing. And he goes on to talk about how Toyota and sort of developed the idea that people would just receive the supplies and the material that they needed for their job at the time that they needed it. And in America, as we Americans do, auto manufacturers answered this complexity by erring on the side of extra. The inefficiency of too much was not just tolerated, it was seen as a strength. We had space, we had cash, and most important, we had a bulldozer-style optimism that insisted customers would buy all additional cars produced simply because we made them. Henry Ford's River Rouge plant was an actual kingdom with 16 million feet of factory floor and over 100 miles of interior railroad track. Ford brought in his own coal on his own barges, smelted his own steel in his own plants, and cast, cut, and machined those 10,000 parts to fit his own internally created gauge, which is to say, he attacked the logistical nightmare of mass auto production by dislocating his jaw and swallowing it whole, a quest for perfect vertical integration. And I highlighted that because I just loved that whole line about that. I think the notion of saying that he attacked a logistical nightmare by dislocating his jaw and swallowing it whole is an excellent and exciting bit of writing there. And I think makes it a much more lively read as a result, which I think helps keep this whole book, which is about 250 pages, moving along at a pretty good pace. And I think that it's also worth saying that the whole experience of writing this must have been challenging, to the extent that how do you make some of this stuff exciting, particularly giving the historical background of how HR now schedules employees for this sort of just-in-time scheduling, and how that relates to early years of auto manufacturing and where this sort of originates from in Japan, shows a deep knowledge and understanding of what it is that he's talking about and his ability to sort of connect these dots in really interesting ways. He goes on to say the cultural effects of this shift of just-in-time scheduling cannot be underestimated. Retail and service sector jobs have always been marked by petty managers and their indiscriminate hiring and firing, and scheduling abuses come part and parcel with low skills and wages in every sector. But just-in-time automates all that. It gives the most callous decisions the imprimatur of technology, offering not just individual deniability, but an actual halo of progress where literal dehumanization, i.e. treating people like parts, can be justified as, quote, valuable for the team. And in doing so, it slowly shifts expectations across the board. When I worked at Whole Foods, for instance, just-in-time scheduling did not officially exist in nomenclature, but the rapid scheduling changes, the short notice, and the sudden demands on time were still very real. They were often against official policy as preached to us by on day one and day two of our orientation, but then they were also relayed to us in the exact same language of efficiency, team play, and smart decision-making that defined the lectures. Most important, we on the floor knew and discussed the realities of the competition, Target, Starbucks, Walmart, and all the other nearby retailers who explicitly used just-in-time. And those conversations flavored the coercion. A soft demand to be a team player was always in reference to how much worse it could be out there if we were ever unlucky enough to do something that would force someone to ask us to play for a different team. This, by the way, is about Whole Foods in about the year or so just prior to the Amazon acquisition of Whole Foods. And so it goes on to say that what we all know, right, that a lot of retail workers get pretty crummy schedules. It prohibits them from having multiple jobs because they never know really when they're going to work. You can't coordinate two jobs if you know that one of them is potentially going to need you on Tuesday, but maybe it won't. So who knows? This really is no way to help people sort of further themselves in their lives and careers. I think this is one of those terrible side effects of capitalism. One of those worst parts of it, actually, is recognizing that in a capitalist society, there will always be poor people. The level of poor and how we define that will shift and change. Poor today is much different than poor from 1950 and poor in 1900. But it doesn't change the fact that we as Americans in particular and people in the West generally view capitalism as a mechanism to improve the quality of standard of things. And so when we see these regressions, we see that it lowers prices because it keeps the supply chain humming along in a way that is maybe a little bit fragile, as we saw during the pandemic, but also means that other people, namely middle class and upper class folks, sadly, get to save more money. They don't have to spend as much money on their food. And I suppose that it's also fair to say that if you are a low income person, that the lower cost of food and the general higher quality of food in comparison to what it was even 50 years ago is a benefit. But these are still problems that are definitely worth challenging. In the last half of the book, he talks about his experience in aquaculture and how the USDA and globally, increasingly, things like salmon and shrimp and crab and other edible meat come to be part of a process that is pretty rough, pretty unregulated, largely regulated by the market itself, largely regulated by suppliers themselves. The difference between the government and like a Walmart and a Kroger is that people complain about the government because they think that there's regulations there that are either too onerous or they increase prices over here for this group of people or have some other adverse consequence. I think my takeaway from this book is that we complain about the government parts of the regulation precisely because we know they're there. We see those debates and hear them because they're out in the open, as opposed to a Walmart or a Kroger or even like a McDonald's, for example. As one example, and it's not in this book, but McDonald's is single-handedly responsible for probably the best improvement in America's potato supply. McDonald's wanted a very specific kind of potato that had a very specific starch to like water ratio because it made for better French fries. It fried better. It was crispy on the outside and soft on the inside. And the majority of America's potatoes prior to McDonald's, or at least early on in the McDonald's run, weren't very good. And they had been sitting for a while and they were kind of mushy and they had lousy ratios and they were inconsistent in their quality and they were inconsistent in size. And McDonald's didn't want that. They couldn't have that. And so like so much of our food and an industrial process of our food distribution system, McDonald's simply fixed it by sheer volume because they needed so many potatoes and because they purchased so many. They managed to sort of single-handedly change the potato industry in this country. And Walmart and a Kroger and Target and Whole Foods and these other retailers do the exact same thing when they start talking about how they want food sourced from specific places that are either no conflict or don't use child labor or dolphin safe and other sorts of things that we sort of see on labels, non-GMO and all organic and these sorts of labels. They're all marketing, but they also have no legal definition and they're entirely driven by the endpoints in the supply chain, which are the retailers. Anyway, there is a component back here about, has a heading. And so caked in the odor of pig shit, made physical on my skin, I meet Kevin in West Hollywood for lunch. He had been walking around in a farm in a hog house. And this was what I talked about earlier in the episode, where he was seeing about 150,000 pigs and that they seemed largely okay, but that it was after that he had a meeting with somebody that he met at the fancy food show. There at the fancy food show, this fella named Kevin is talking about the retail layout of stores And in so doing, he was really fascinated by what he was talking about. And so he wanted to have an interview. And he says of Kevin, he's like, "Truly, I haven't prepared for this interview. I wasn't entirely expecting it. I'm disoriented from sleep deprivation. And while I try to get my bearings, I ask him about business. I expect he has a pre-baked promotional spiel that he can launch into. Instead, he just shakes his head sadly. It's like an alcoholic calling," he says. "These stores have nowhere to turn, and so they call me. This is a dying business, and nobody knows what hit them." And Kevin, in this context, by the way, is talking mostly about smaller regional mid-size stores, not the Walmarts and the Targets and the Whole Foods of the world, but think like the Safeways and the Save-A-Lots and the local regional brands that you sometimes shop at. "I'm aware of the current retail apocalypse," he writes, "but it isn't new, nor what I came for. I want Kevin to talk about retail architecture, about marrying interior design with psychology, about creating bliss points that facilitate the consumer and create joy," as he talked about in his talk at the Fancy Food Show. He says, "They all want to play the quantification game," he continues. "Well, guess what? You aren't going to out-quantify Amazon. And if you think you can run a lumberyard of food that is going to beat Walmart, you're crazy." And this to me was a real eye-opening point where I hadn't really thought about a retail apocalypse, but it does seem like the logical endpoint of our food system is that we have a handful of incredibly large retailers and that food is by and large treated not much differently than how we treat, I don't know, tires, where there's just a handful of retailers and like all of our options kind of get funneled through those sorts of things. And that the small niche players, like bookstores, are just going to be, they're just going to be completely worn out of this whole system. He also goes on to talk about the bottom of the commodity chain, where he travels to Thailand and he meets a person named Toon Lin. And he talks about how this fella, when he was a teenager, in Myanmar, flees across the border to Thailand and immediately gets sort of picked up in this process where him and probably thousands of other people every year are sold into effectively slavery. He's told that he's going to go on a fishing boat, and the fishing boat, in the way that the modern fishing industry works in a lot of places, is that the supplies come to the boat. The boat never comes back to the dock. And so the people who end up on this boat are subjected to incredibly harsh conditions. There's, you know, beatings. They have no access to healthcare. They have no access to really much good food in a lot of cases. And the captain of the boat is generally, the deal seems to be that you will work on this boat for 5 years or some determined amount of time. You don't know how long that time is going to be. But in this circumstance for Toon Lin, it was 5 years. And then we'll take you back and then you can do whatever. But in that time, because the conditions are so dangerous and the work is so dangerous, he goes on a wonderful, wonderfully detailed story about his work there, the danger that he faced, including losing part of his hand, and the weather that they endured, his loss of his connection to his family, and having really no connection at all to the outside world. It truly is modern day slavery. And it is slavery in the sense that he definitely didn't get paid for it. There is a footnote in here that takes into consideration that comparing slavery is always a challenging thing because there's what America did in our slave trade and what other countries did in their slave trade prior to that. And comparing it to the modern day where, you know, you're not so much shipped across an ocean at gunpoint, but you kind of are. Like, it's close, right? Like, if you're in Myanmar in a war-ravaged country and you're trying to escape and you end up in Thailand and somebody comes along and sort of says, "Hey, you know, I'll recruit you into this operation. You'll make all sorts of money that you can take back to wherever." Most people would take that in a heartbeat, and people do. And in this circumstance, what they really get is not what they thought they were. It's a fascinating tale, and it all leads up to the idea that part of what makes, in this context, fishing, specifically shrimp, so cheap in America, and what has made it so cheap, even in over the last 25 or 30 years, is the work of people like Tun Lin, who gets sold into slavery, because the supply chain is constantly looking for lower and lower and lower prices, and things, there's got to be a bottom someplace, right? There's got to be a floor on these things. And when people start looking for lower and lower price points, inevitably you start digging through the floor. And when you start digging through the floor, you end up in situations where you've taken people hostage and have started to put them into slavery. This whole book is incredibly fascinating. I enjoyed every part of it. Every chapter was incredibly well researched. It was a little bit funny. I give it 4 stars, only because I don't really know what I'm supposed to do with the information. I don't know what to do to change my life or change my world to make this better for people. It's not like I can go into a Whole Foods or a Kroger and pay an extra dollar for shrimp and say, hey, can you give this extra dollar to the, you know, down the line into the supply chain, so that way it actually makes it to the person who ended up purchasing, or, you know, excuse me, you know, hauling in the shrimp. The aquaculture of things is increasingly just as unsettling as our industrial agriculture in this country. I think if there's one good thing that comes of our industrial agriculture in the United States, it's that clearly, despite the animal abuses that are almost certainly happening, it doesn't seem like the worker abuses are nearly as bad as what they are in places like Thailand and Bangkok, where an entire sector of people are sort of driven into this industry because that's what is there, right? And in the process of writing this book, there have been news accounts and reports of places that are sourcing food, in this case shrimp, into grocery stores that Americans would be appalled and shocked at if they had known. They probably wouldn't have bought that food. But a lot of the retailers respond by saying that, hey, none of our food has that. In this case, the Whole Foods corporate was saying, like, no, we don't use any of that sort of slave labor or have any of those conditions in our supply chain. And the New York Times and NPR and other investigations have proven, like, actually, you don't know that. Like, that may be true, but you don't know that. You actually can't say for certain, no, there is no labor abuses in our supply chain, because so much of it gets mixed and mingled along the way through various brokers and middlemen that all serve important roles in sort of making the whole system run, that you don't know. We don't know. And so short of, I guess, growing our own food in our own backyards, there's probably not a whole lot that we're going to be able to do, at least not in the short term anyway, to sort of fix the secret life of our groceries. So highly recommend this book if you're a person who, I don't know, eats. Because if you're a person who eats, you should at least make an effort to understand precisely where your food comes from.